bedroom. Yes.
What would the practical use be to put Kiddushin and Nisuin so far apart if there any way there was engagement before?
What do you mean?
What's the practical use?
Why? What?
Kiddushin and Nisuin.
You're asking me a historical question.
Yeah.
Why is it that Kiddushin and Nisuin were separated?
Right.
Well, the basic reason was that the Kiddushin meant to secure the marriage, but frequently this took place long before the husband was either old enough really to consummate the marriage physically or financially responsible enough to bear the cost. I mean, why do you have an engagement? I mean, let's look at today's society. Why is there such a thing as an engagement? Why don't people just decide to get married and get married? Yeah, well, all right. There may be some compensation in the form of a diamond ring, but obviously, even in today's society, there is some good reason, preparation for the marriage, what have you, getting adjusted and so on, to arrange for something which we call an engagement, which is an obligation to undertake marriage, whereas the actual marriage doesn't take place until later.
So Kiddushin is an engagement?
No. So, what happens is that how serious is this engagement? Well, today we feel that breaking off an engagement is somewhat embarrassing, but it's not as serious as a divorce. But of course, with divorce becoming more and more prevalent, maybe breaking off an engagement is equivalent to a divorce. There was a time in which this notion of engagement was intended to be taken so seriously that breaking off the engagement was tantamount to a divorce. In other words, we know from our own present circumstances that there are good economic and sociological reasons to have a separation between the announcement of the marriage or the undertaking to get married and the actual marriage itself. Your only question is, why was that original Kiddushin so serious? Why wasn't it like we have today, that there are social penalties but not legal penalties against breaking an engagement? But the need for an engagement is clear.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it moves sort of in 1,000 or 2,000 year cycles. I mean, what happens is what happened, of course, was that the Kiddushin and the Nisuin became joined together around the 10th or the 11th century, exactly for these kinds of problems, because of disruption of society in which being married to the woman and really not married carried with it too many dangers in a society which was constantly under threat and so on. But then, of course, the notion of Shidduchin came into place. And then the notion of Tnoim came into place. I mean, today, for instance, you have a crazy situation in which at many religious weddings you have a Tnoim a half an hour before the Kiddushin, right? You have three things happening at once. The reason for that being that the penalty attached to the Tnoim became so serious and onerous that you didn't really want to have a Tnoim which was separated from the Kiddushin. Am I making myself clear? You need something which tells you that these people are engaged but not yet married. Then you become concerned that maybe this engagement really isn't all that serious. So you make it more and more difficult to break an engagement. Finally, you make it impossible to break an engagement, but then you're back in a situation where she's married and not married. So then you bring that up exactly to the point of the actual marriage, and then you need something else. So now you need a vault or what have you to replace the tnaim which have become too serious. Of course, it's ridiculous to have the tnaim there at the time of the marriage, but it's an indication that there really is a societal need for two separate things: the declaration of when this couple is going to get married, and then enough time to prepare for the actual wedding. And that declaration acquires more and more and more onerous penalties, at which point it becomes so onerous that you can't have it separated in time from the actual marriage, and you move it up and replace it with something else. Okay? Yeah?
And suddenly you don't break an engagement, get married and get divorced.
Yeah, because the tnaim have become so serious that breaking the engagement is more serious than getting the divorce. It's a reflection on your moral, your commitment to your word if you break an engagement, whereas a divorce is just a divorce. So, but again, once you're in that situation, you then move the engagement right up to the time of the divorce. Excuse me, the time of the marriage. Okay, now. All right. Okay. So we have several problems here. And as I said, the very analysis of this problem becomes complicated. What right, in two of the five, in three of the six cases, we can understand the mechanism. In the case of Hillel HaZaken, he says that this was a clause. Of course, his evidence was that he had a selected number of ketubot, and they could be interpreted as a clause saying that the kedushin was not to take effect until just before the nisuin. He then interpreted this language to mean that that was actually a clause, and then he invoked the legal fiction as saying that all marriages in Alexandria, whether or not their ketubot did contain this clause, intended to put this clause in, and therefore all marriages in Alexandria were declared conditional. So of course we can accept this either as a very clever legal fiction on Hillel HaZaken's part, or we can say that maybe he reinterpreted all of the contracts, but the mechanism is clear. He's taken a portion of private contract law, generalized it, and maybe converted it into a fiction, but at least with that fiction we have the interpretation this was part of the contract. In the case of the reverse decision of Naresh, where the man who, in quotes, abducted the woman got married, and that marriage was declared null and void, we understand the mechanism there also somewhat, at least in the case where there is where the kedushin itself was kesef because of hefker bezdin hefker, that the rabbis intervened to prevent that marriage from taking place. In the case of what was the other case of Tlua of the Kitcha, in the case of a coerced marriage, equally well, the rabbis prevented the original marriage ever from taking place. The other three cases are much more problematical because what the rabbis are doing are validating a divorce which had no validity. So they're declaring a marriage which has been physically, mentally, emotionally, economically, sociologically in existence maybe for many years to be null and void. Did they do this retroactively? If so, with what power? It certainly was not in the intent of anybody at the time of the marriage contract, even by remote stretches of the imagination, that this was what they intended to do. And if you're going to say that they made it contingent on rabbinical decision, it's a difficult notion that this rabbinical decision will come after so many years of marriage. On the other hand, the power really exists. And the question that the Rashba is addressed in the first tshuva that we will study is that if this power exists, why don't they use it? There are other situations in which the woman is caught in a bind, not just this one. And therefore, why doesn't the Gemara use this power in other circumstances as well? Now there is one other case, which also those of you who have been coming to the Shiurim over the past 40 years know that we've studied many times, where the Gemara doesn't explicitly say that it's using the power of Hafka'at Kedushin to do what it needs to do, but there's a hint of it, and also Rashi says so explicitly, and that is in the case of a missing husband. In the case where of Agunot, where there is insufficient testimony, there are no two witnesses to the death of the husband, the Gemara says, for example, that eid echad b'isha is enough. If you have one witness that the husband has died, then the woman can remarry. What right do the rabbis have to change the laws of evidence in favor of the woman, allowing her to remarry when, if you strictly interpret the requirements of the Torah of two witnesses to establish all facts, there isn't enough legal evidence to allow her to remarry? The Gemara seems to hint at this, at the fact that the rabbis have this power because of their generalized power to change all things. Yesh koch b'yad chachamim la'akor davar min haTorah. Rashi, in fact, takes it explicitly to be the power that's peculiar to kedushin on hafkat kedushin. So it's well to bear that in mind when we read this tshuva of the Rashba. Parapinyon. Sha'al tet. Mumar la avoda zara shekidesh bat Yisrael the kedusha of kiddushin. Just an unfortunate problem: a Jewish man marries a Jewish woman and then converts to Christianity, or vice versa. He may have done it after he converted. It doesn't matter. The man has left the Jewish community and the Jewish faith, and therefore the Jewish courts no longer have any authority over him. They can't force him to give a get. Or even a case of a man who converts to Judaism temporarily and then reverts to Christianity. If he marries a Jewish woman in this interval, the kedushin is valid because he's legally considered as a Jew. But practically speaking, he's not a Jew because we can't exert our power over him to force him to do anything. He's left the community. Why did not the rabbis worry about this case? The poor woman is now trapped. She's legally married to a man who has left her, and the courts have no power whatsoever over the husband to coerce him to issue a divorce. Whereas they did worry about the woman's fate in the case of the missing husband, where they allowed a single witness to testify, afilu eved v'afilu shivcha. V'halo yesh kan igun yoter. In the case of the missing husband, perhaps there's some chance that more evidence will come in and eventually the situation will clarify itself. But in a case like this, it's hopeless. The Jewish courts will never have any control over this man. He's disappeared into the Christian community, and there's no way of compelling him to give a divorce. That's the problem. If the rabbis indeed have the power over kedushin, why don't they exercise it in this particular case? Tshuva. Now, what he's going to answer is that they don't have the power. That is, in all of the cases, an unfortunate but clear answer. That the reason that they don't exercise this power in all cases, that they don't even have the power to do so in the cases which are mentioned in the Gemara, that there's another mechanism in operation. So let's see what he says. Tshuva. Ha'hud eid echad lo mishum aguna levad amru. The issue there wasn't merely the concern about the fate of the woman. So this was not a pure rabbinical enactment, is what he's saying. The first attempt to explain why a single witness is valid in the case of the missing husband is because maybe you only need a single witness in those cases. Umiu lo akili ba elo mishum de itita daika uminsava. Vahi lo daika amiran teitse mize umize velo afkinun likidushin. The Rashba's answer is, first of all, the Gemara never explicitly said that they used the phrase of afkaat kidushin. The first attempt of the Gemara at rationalizing why the rules of evidence have changed in the case of a woman with a missing husband was because, in fact, the rules of evidence allowed for just a single witness. And when the Gemara couldn't sustain that, it came away with a different theory. The theory is that the burden of penalty falls on this woman. You're going to allow her to remarry, but the woman herself is going to be sure that she's not going to remarry unless she's sure that her husband is dead.
It's an awful risk for her.
It's an awful risk for her to remarry. And therefore, since a woman is not going to remarry unless her husband is dead, or unless she's absolutely convinced that her husband is dead, then you can say that no woman is in fact going to remarry unless she's really investigated the situation. So what the court is doing is making sure that there's some supplementary evidence, like a single witness, this, that, or the other thing. But basically, it's the woman who bears the burden here, and if she's willing to take the risk, then we're willing to go along with it. That's basic.
According to the view, is
offspring of the second marriage are mamzerim or not? Or is it not dependent on what
Aisha? No. And then Rashba points out that if the husband does indeed return, then the offspring of the second marriage are declared as mamzerim. So therefore the penalties on this woman are severe. But on the other hand, you don't want this woman never to be allowed to remarry. So if we say, the rabbis say to her, you take the risk. We're willing to go along with this risk if there's some corroborating evidence. But basically, if you're willing to undertake the risk, we're willing to say that you wouldn't do this unless the husband was likely to be dead. And of course, in practical cases, and remember, we studied hundreds and hundreds of actual cases of Agunot, in all situations in which the mechanism works, you, the rabbi who's deciding the case, have to be convinced in your own mind that the husband is dead. Then you write the report. I mean, I assume it happens in medicine. You sort of know what the illness is, and then when you write the report, you have to follow some guidelines to meet whatever the Medicare requires or what have you. But you have to have the first thing is the gut reaction. You have to be convinced in your own mind that your diagnosis is correct. So the way it actually worked in practice over a couple of thousand years is the rabbi who was asked to decide for this woman was first of all convinced in his own mind by all kinds of corroborating evidence that the husband was indeed dead, and then he writes a legal brief which supports this on the basis of the requirements. Similarly, the Rashba is saying that was really what was going on with the Takana, that the woman bears the burden of responsibility. She is the one, she's not going to get remarried unless she's sure that her husband is dead. That's first of all in the nature of things, and second because of the penalties that she's going to be subjected to. And therefore we're willing to go along with the relaxing the formal rules of evidence. But the Rashba says the notion of hafka'at kiddushin, the power of the rabbis to annul a marriage or terminate the marriage, will never result in this case. Okay, so he says that never occurred.
So what was against the Rashba? What was the data point?
Yeah, normally in questions which carry a capital penalty, you need two edim. Right? Okay. Pishnei edim yakom davar. Pishnei edim yumata. Shalshosha edim yumata meh.
The best is yafalakor to break
down. The Gemara discusses all of that, but the Rashba is saying that the mechanism in the case of allowing one witness to testify to the death of a husband is not that of annulment of a marriage or termination of the marriage. And in fact, if the husband comes back alive, the original marriage is not terminated. That's the best proof that the marriage has not been terminated. The rabbis could have said, we're going to annul the marriage retroactively. In which case, if the first husband comes back, the children from the second marriage are not mamzerim. But the rabbis didn't say that. So the Rashba says, this notion that the rabbis can annul or terminate a marriage is not true, at least as far as the case of the testimony for a missing husband is concerned.
I don't know why I'm fixated on this, but if the husband subsequently shows up, that means that the second husband in fact receives an onesh for now being an adulterer?
He doesn't receive an onesh. Unfortunately, the children receive the onesh.
Okay, but there's no meetup for the second
husband? No, there's no penalty. He's not going to be punished by the courts. Unfortunately, the ones that bear unfairly the burden here will be the children of the second marriage. But in any event, what we see from this is that the first marriage has not been revoked. Umiu vadai mizimnin demafaki kiddushin mikshash igun. There are places in which the kiddushin have been revoked because of concern about the fate of the woman. Ukidiyamar ein ta'anat ones begitin. Like in the case of the Gemara in Ketubot, where the man is screaming that he can't get across the river, but nevertheless the divorce is valid. The afal gav de lagabe mamona habitaina, even though as far as civil law is concerned, as far as contract law is concerned, force majeure is a legitimate claim. Afka inu rabbanon lekidushin mishum tznuot and mishum putzot. Even in time of mishum the kol makadesh adatet rabbanon makadesh viafkinu rabbanon lekidushin. There, in the case of the Gemara that we've just cited, the Gemara explicitly says afka inu rabbanon lekidushin. But the Rashba says, Even there, kol ikra de milta lav mishum iguna bilchudu. He's saying that there's a non-linear effect here. There's, if you analyze it, there's a feedback effect on the husband's mental state once the rabbis have issued this law. In other words, let me explain it to you in words, and then we'll read it in Rashi. What he's saying is this: a man gives a wife a get. Under normal contract law, if a man says, I'm going to sell you my house conditional on my not returning within a year, and it turns out that, as happens, Amtrak breaks down and I can't get up to Boston in time, I can claim that I never intended that. And therefore the sale is invalid. Okay. But now suppose that the state law says that no matter what, the contract is valid. Then I no longer have a claim of force majeure, because I know in advance that when I say that if I can't get back, that excludes force majeure. In other words, the law changes the way I view the original contract. If the rabbis have said that no matter what, this get is valid, then at the time that the guy writes the get, he knows that he better get back, and that if he doesn't get back, the get will be valid. And therefore he won't write such a get without undertaking that the get will be valid no matter what. In other words, here is a situation where, as in all contracts, it's the background which affects the interpretation of what the clause means. The clause could have been written explicitly. It could have been written, you're going to be divorced whether I get back or not, if I don't come back within 12 months, no matter what, if there's a hurricane, if there's an earthquake, if there's a war, if the bridge breaks down, even if it's forces beyond my control, this get is valid no matter what. If that was explicitly stipulated in the divorce, then of course the divorce would be valid and the claim of force majeure would not be legitimate, because the clause explicitly excludes force majeure as a claim. The issue is that stipulation was not written into the divorce. So we now have to interpret what the husband meant when he said, you're divorced within 12 months if I don't get back. That depends upon the overall background, on the context in which this clause has been written. When the rabbis say that this divorce is going to be valid no matter what, then the background of that clause has been changed, and therefore the interpretation of that clause has been changed. The husband knows that he should not issue such a conditional divorce unless he's willing to bear the penalties of its being enforced, even if he can't meet the claims against him, right? So that's what the Rashba is saying, that there's not really a rabbinical annulment of the marriage. This marriage that has been going on for 40 years has not been retroactively cancelled, and therefore you're going to say that the husband can marry the wife's relatives and so on because he was never married to her under such a situation. After all, there are legal consequences of whether the marriage had never taken place or not. The Rashba is saying that since the rabbis are threatening to annul this marriage, then this divorce has become validated even though he did not explicitly say that force majeure is not a claim. Yes. That's a perfectly legitimate question. But the Rashba is willing to stretch the language of the Gemara to deal with what he regards as an impossible, uninterpretable position. Namely, he is, as many of the Rishonim during that period are, a firm believer in individual rights, in the sense that the rabbis don't interfere in personal contract all that much, and especially on the issue of Kedushin. If this has now become a holy matrimony instead of a contract, what rights does even Rabban Gamliel have to intervene in the holy relationship between a man and a wife? So therefore, he's faced between two alternatives: a literal interpretation of the Gemara, which is an impossible position to maintain theoretically, or a stretching of the interpretation of the Gemara to make it compatible with the view that what's happening here is an actual divorce. Remember, no matter what, we're faced with the problem that it'll be extraordinarily difficult for us to interpret Afkeinu Rabbanu L'Kiddushin Mineh to mean that this marriage, which has been in effect for 40 years, never took place. I mean, that's really a stretch. So unless you're willing to swallow that, which is a big pill to swallow, it's a lot easier to say that what's happened here is that the divorce has been validated because you've changed the mental state of the husband at the time that he wrote it. Okay, so that's what he says. All right? Wafilu hatam, Rashba, let's read it in his language. Wafilu hatam, kol ikra demilta lav mishum iguna bilchutu. The whole issue there is not simply because we're concerned with the wife and therefore we're going to revoke the marriage. Ela mishum deman deyahid vita kiha, ki heichi delo lafkino rabbanan lekedushin minei, umashvin lebilato beilatznut. Since he doesn't want the rabbis to revoke his marriage retroactively and make all of his sexual relations that he thought were within the marriage acts of fornication, he doesn't want all of that to happen. Asuk masika date kol unsa de shkia. He is therefore willing to accept all normal types of force majeure. Vapilo shachiach velo shachiach machile. And even rare accidents, he will be willing to sustain them. Habichdi, but without this additional twist, lo afkein. But without thing, they did not revoke the kedusha. V'teda locha, daha tava v'mayim she'ein lahem sof, lo afkeina, v'lo chashu le'inyan liyur. The rabbis, for example, have said that if a man drowns in mayim she'ein lahem sof, if you see a man disappear under the waves where you can't see the shore in all directions, then the wife is not allowed to remarry, even though this poor woman is now in a state where she can't remarry. The Alma lo amu ela ika smach yahid eid echad esamchinen en saduta de eid. Ba'afilu v'goy me'siach lefitumo, u'mishum de'ihu daikol minzibah. U'v'get, and in the case of divorce, mishum v'samchin leima da'askile lehol unsa adatei v'achudei v'lehetnai. V'teda lecha, da'ahi unsa v'lo shchiach, da'achlo ari v'nashko nachash v'nafal ha'bayit, ha'vi unsa mishum unta unsa v'lo shchiach lo asaka da'atei. U'v'tolava kidesh, in the case where there was a coerced marriage, or in the case where there was the abduction, which should be kursai, I suppose, the afkinu abon on the kedushin below its tzricha geta, where they revoke the marriage and don't require it yet, hatam hainu taimam mishum de ikar hakedushin hayu shelo v'otzana chachamim. That's because the original marriage was against the wishes of the chazal. In other words, it's much easier to understand the suspension of a marriage, that is, the lack of recognition of a marriage, the declaration of a marriage ab initio, before it actually takes place, as being invalid, but there was never any retroactive or a posteriori termination of a marriage.
The first time?
We had two cases in the Gemara. We had two cases in the Gemara where the Gemara says, who asa shelo kahogen, right? Where the groom acted improperly, and therefore the rabbis have declared the marriage to be null and void. The Rashba is saying, very simply, that there's a big difference between declaring a marriage to be null and void from the very beginning, not recognizing a marriage, right? And saying that like an existing marriage, which had until that point been recognized as being either annulled or terminated. And he's making the case that there is no situation in which there was an annulment or the termination of an existing marriage. That's his position. The rabbis simply don't have that power. Okay? All right. Okay, maybe we will skip that rest of the tshuva, because the position of the Rashba is clear. The question is, how did the rabbis have this power? It's answered in the simplest possible way. They didn't have the power. And what the mechanism that made it work was either the non-recognition of a marriage before it took place, or as it was taking place, or the change of the mental background of the husband, which made something that might have been construed as a get, and not a get because of some force majeure, construed as a get, because he's willing to undertake all this. Now we will see, passing down a couple of centuries, that the actual practice in times of distress doesn't bear the Rashba out. So now let's go to the next page, which is a very brief quotation from the Dalki Moshe, from the Ramah, from Moshe Issachar. The issue here is, what about women who have been captured, forcibly converted, and so on, where there's prima facie evidence that they either have been raped or otherwise, in other words, that there's been, can they return to their husbands? Okay, especially if a husband is a Kohen. Right? Remember that if in the case of a rape victim, a Yisrael, the wife can return, but if the husband is a Kohen, even a claim of rape does not allow the woman to return. Okay. Omnam, on the second line, it's a little hard to read. Begzerot Ostreich, in the Austrian persecutions, do you have it? It's the second line, sort of halfway down the line, a little bit towards the end of the line.
The space between Darkei and Moshe.
Yeah, just under the Darkei.
Coordinate.
Right. And page 15, seven, whatever, it looks like this. Omnam Begzerot Ostreich, Hutru al pi gdolim gam kein l'va'aleihem. The rabbinical authorities allowed these women who had been captured and presumably raped and otherwise to return to their husbands, afilu l'kohanim, and even when their husbands were kohanim. The efshal natnu hani nashi amtol l'dvayim kuli mayin sham kiherich. Perhaps these women were able to make some kind of an excuse to a claim that they were not actually raped, and see that he makes a long discussion of that. And now the Rama is adding his own opinion, his own ex post facto interpretation of the action of the rabbinical authorities in Austria a century before. Perhaps the rabbis who allowed these women to return to their husbands loved Medina, not because they were allowed to return to their husbands according to the strict interpretation of the law, Ela mishum tzorech sha'a, because the needs of the time require the women to be allowed to return to their times. Sha'ra'u sheyes chashva shalom lachush la'atid lanashim, because one needed to worry about what would happen in cases of future persecutions. That women, that if they were to know that they would, she'im yedu she'lo yutru yachzuru l'ba'al l'ureihem, if a woman who was taken into captivity that would know that no matter what, she would not be allowed to return to her husband, she would give up, right? She'lo yakalkulu, she would, l'chein hekilu. And therefore the rabbis allowed these women to return to their husbands, because otherwise, for fear of what would happen in future persecutions, the Jewish women would just simply, yeah. The ein lomar minalan lomar kein. Don't say, how do we know that they could do such a thing? The yesh lahakel v'chashish yishur d'oraita. How do we know that the rabbis could do this? After all, these were married women, and they're allowing them to return to their kohen, to husbands who are kohenim, which is an yisur d'oraita. Nira li de samchu ahadi aminan kol de makadesh adaita de rabbanan makadesh. Ve'yesh koach b'yad beitin lafkui kiddushin minayu v'havi kipnuyot. So he's saying that under these circumstances, the local rabbis in Austria have the right to revoke the original marriages and declare these women, as far as this law is concerned, as never having been married, and therefore using their power of revocation, retroactively declared these women not to be married and therefore to return to their husbands. So here is an illustration where, according to the Ramah, the rabbis actually exercised their authority in the case of an existing marriage retroactively, in complete contrast to the Rashba's position that such a power never existed.
Is this what Rabbi means when the Lakar at the right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Revoked.
Right, they revoked the original marriage.
Retroactively. But they didn't say that. I mean, the Ramah interprets it.
The Ramah is interpreting, they said,
go home.
Go home. And he's saying, let's cut through all of the quibbles and legal strains of trying to understand their decision. Their decision was based on pure public interest and common sense. If you don't allow women to return home, then in the future no woman will be able to remain, to have any hope when she's captured, and therefore she will just simply
give in
and never return to the Jewish community. Therefore you have to do something. You cannot allow this Hennis law, which prevents a raped woman to return to her husband who is a Kohen, to survive in a case, if it was just an isolated case, you know, of one single rape occurring 50 or 100 years, well, maybe this poor woman who's an isolated case would have to bear the brunt of a difficult law. But in a situation where you're dealing with generalized persecution and a problem which is going to affect a large class of women, the rabbis had to do something. And don't go into legal quibbles of how they did it. They did it by revoking the marriage. That's within their power.
But wasn't that the case as well in Alexandria?
Sure it was. But the Rashba is denying that. He had a different perspective. He had a different perspective both on the nature of Kiddushin and Nisuin, and he had a different perspective on the nature of rabbinical authority.
What made for the different perspective?
Well, first of all, it's consistent with a whole lot of things. One is the Rashba's very conservative position on a number of issues. And secondly, it's an attempt, what we might call libertarian. If all contract is private, then what right do the rabbis have to intervene? Right? So what the Ramah is saying is something which is, hinges on being drastic, and we'll see that it gets even more drastic in the next... In with his contemporaries and in the next centuries, namely that marriage is not a purely private contract between two individuals. And that just as today, for example, marriage is regulated by the state in Massachusetts, you know, a man and a woman can't just declare themselves to be married to one another. The state intervenes. It doesn't really intervene in buying a bicycle, but it does intervene in marrying a wife. Similarly, what he is saying is that marriage, if we remove all the dross, what he is saying is that marriage is no longer to be construed or should never be construed as a purely private contract between two individuals as in Roman law, but is a form of contract in which the Jewish community as a whole, as represented by its legal authorities, have a right to intervene. So it's a form of governmental intervention as opposed to private law. And these are really two quite drastic things. Do you want socialized medicine, where the government says how medical care has been provided because it's too important a service to the community to be allowed to be controlled purely by private contract? Or do you want doctors to be able to charge what they please? Or do you want insurance companies to be able to let market forces intervene? I mean, that's the nature of this difference. It's really a difference of philosophy which we can abstract from the rest of the things, but it's combined with a whole lot of other things like religious conservatism. The Ramah's position is contrary to, say, what you would learn in the yeshivas as the typical position. And that's why I'm bringing it as from the Ramah, because it's striking. We will see next week that the Shultei HaGiborim goes much, much further, and I would say overboard, in this direction, and then we will see what some of the later authorities have to say. What is dreadful, of course, is that this whole development froze. The current rabbinical authorities are completely frightened to use any of this, and the woman, unfortunately, both in the United States and in Israel, is placed in an extremely difficult and untenable situation as far as current marriage law is concerned.
Why? Explain again why the revocation of the initial marriage helped in the case of the Kohen.
She was never married to him.
Yeah, but isn't the problem that
why should she go back to law?
Because she was never a Zona. A Zona is by definition not a woman who has intercourse with an unmarried. When she's unmarried, it's a married woman who commits adultery. She was never a married woman.
But the act that she had with the Gentiles.
She's made. Yeah.
For a Kohen. But she's not.
Well, no, there's no requirement of betulah. There's only a requirement that the woman not be an adulteress. She's not an adulteress because she was never married. This is a fiction, of course, but the fiction
has to at least be a consistent fiction.
Yeah, here's the consistent fiction. They revoked the marriage initially. She was never married to him.
But the act that she committed or was committed to her with the Gentile is...
That's a much more secondary problem.
Okay.
So it takes it out of the level you're saying that sexual relations with a guy in and of themselves might make her into Zona.
She goes back to the Kohen to remarry?
Yeah.
she would get remarried.
Yeah.